When Kate Ranta found herself in an abusive relationship, she took her four-year-old son and got out. But that only led to more danger as her ex tracked her down and shot both her and her father. But Kate survived, and after experiencing the worst of domestic violence, gun culture, and a system that seems designed to protect abusers, she reinvented herself as an activist and author, which makes Kate Ranta wonder,
Why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we've ripped from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, and with me is Kate Ranta, author of Killing Kate, a story of turning abuse and tragedy into transformation and triumph, co-written with Elisa Devine and based on Kate's own harrowing story. Kate, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us about how you escaped domestic abuse and turned your experience into a life of activism and why your story needs to be a movie.
Hi, thank you for having me. So back in the mid-2000s, I was a single mom living in Washington, D.C. My son Henry was ages 1 to 3. And I was dating, you know, nothing really serious. Friends of mine had started online dating and encouraged me to try it out. I was like, okay, sure, you know, I'll try it. Not knowing the free-for-all it could be for people like my ex. So
early 2000s, it was really in its infancy too. And so
correct.
None of us were good at looking at red flags or anything.
Not at all. It didn't even occur to me to look for red flags. So basically I went on and created my profile and went through the list of, you know, men that were in my area and decided to I guess back then it was wink at them. And my ex was one of them. And I found him particularly just handsome picture wise. And that he had, and in his profile, he said he had no children and I did. So I sort of thought it was a long shot that he would be interested in me. But the next morning I signed on and he had winked back, and that would lead to lots of back and forth messaging on the platform. Then we exchanged numbers and texted back and forth and phone calls, which led to deciding on a date. He picked me up again. Back then we didn't sort of know the etiquette and safety about online dating. I gave him my address and actually had him come pick me up because that's what guys were supposed to do, right? So I remember he showed up at my door and he had flowers with him, and I opened up the door and he had this really big, curly, giant white smile and was like, "Hi, I'm Tom." And it sounded, the way he said it, it sounded very fake to me. And I did have a beat when I looked at him and I saw him and I saw the smile and I heard the way he spoke. I did have a beat where I was like, you know, and then I just blew it off. I you know, took the flowers, put them in a vase. We're just going to go out on a date. We went for sushi. The thing I remember about the first date was his intensity, like almost hanging on every word that I said and staring at me very intently and asking a lot of questions, which would glean information for him from me. And he also did a lot of bragging about being in the military and that he was a government contractor, military contractor, and bought parts/bombs for the Predator. Like that was his job. And so it all sounded very, I'd never dated anybody in the military before. My parents were educators. I didn't grow up with really anybody in the military. This was all sort of new territory for me. And I feel like in a way, it vetted him for me because he was an officer. So obviously he had an education. He worked on the Predator. So it's like kind of top secret clearances or high clearances anyway.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of responsibility.
Right. And respectability
that
comes with it. And I almost naively trusted in that I think, in a way, versus meeting some just random guy who works in corporate, if that makes sense. So what would unfold then was a whirlwind, the sweep me off my feet type of thing, which I had never experienced before. My past relationships, I usually, you know, I dated, like I'd been married more than once. I had dated, you know, for at least a couple of years, if not more, and then, you know, moved to the next step. But with this, we were engaged within 3 months and married within 6. And I was also pregnant with my son, William, that I have with him. So I didn't realize at the time that that was a big red flag, how quickly he was really moving the relationship along. He wanted me to move in very quickly.
I'm not sure we like collectively sort of saw that pattern until like this century.
Correct.
That's when I first, you know, started reading about that and that, yeah, the abusers will like charm you and sweep you off your feet and move in very fast and then get you in a position right. where you're.
Right. And I had no idea. And to me at 34 and a single mom, and I thought, you know, he's 5 years older than me and we seemed to be on the same page and wanting the same things. I wanted a family. I wanted another child. I thought
you get married, you have a baby. That's the happy ending.
I thought we were on the same level and that's what we wanted. That's what he indicated to me that he wanted. So it all seemed very romantic to me. And now obviously in retrospect, I know that it was a giant red flag that he wanted to move it that quickly.
But it's so much harder to see why you're in it, or, you know, millions of women wouldn't be in this position. Like,
right.
And also, right. again, if you just hit all the story beats one by one, like it's a romantic comedy. There's no, you know, it's a right. whirlwind romance. And
it is the quintessential Hollywood, these two people meet and fall in love, and it's this great romance, and they can't live without each other. And it does follow that pattern, but we know the dark side of it, which is what happened to me.
But there's probably a scenario in which all those things happen and it moves fast because you're crazy about each other. It's a good relationship. And like those same chain of events happen and they take a, you know, right turn instead of a left turn. And
I like agree.
You can't know when you're in it, I don't think.
No. And these guys don't come into the relationship waving a flag saying, I'm a sociopathic abuser. Obviously,
yeah, exactly.
They have their best face, their best, you know, they have that mask up. They're charming and charismatic. And he was Mr. Fix-It. Come, you know, swoop in and I'm a single mom. You know, he could make my life better. He could make it easier. He could make things easier on me. And he was supportive and he paid attention to my son and bought things for him and seemed very involved. And I didn't see a lot of the subtle hints that were there early on. It wasn't until I was way far into it that it became really obvious.
Right, right.
So, right, the engagement happened. I was pregnant. And I would say about the pregnancy that when I told him about it, I expected like joy. You know, I thought we were on the same page. We'd talked about this and there was almost like a fake smile, but something behind it that I couldn't quite put my finger on. He wasn't joyous. So to me, that gave some pause too.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the pregnancy it was okay. I had like some panic attacks during it and he would be right there. He actually was very involved and seemingly supportive during the pregnancy, especially when I was kind of struggling with having, I don't know if it was like hormonal panic attacks or something, but you know, he seemed to dote on me a little bit. In March of 2008, we were engaged. I was pregnant. We decided to go off to Vegas and get married. And I was really excited. You know, we did like kind of like a little white chapel wedding and it was a lot of fun. But the thing that really derailed it was the day after we got married. in the car casually says to me, "So I went through the steps in my head about how I was going to kill my ex."
Jesus.
Right. So, you know, normally you would think you would react like, "What?" and like, "Get me out of this car. Like, I'm getting out of here. I'm getting this annulled. We're done." But the way that he presented it was very just matter of fact. You know, I said, "What? What are you talking about?" And he said, "Yeah, I went through the steps in my head about how I was going to kill her. I was going to kidnap her and put her in the trunk and, you know, dump her somewhere," something like that. And I was like, "Well, that doesn't sound right. That doesn't sound normal. I've been divorced before. We weren't the best of friends, but I never went through any sort of scenario in my head where I would harm this person." And he said, "Oh, well, my therapist told me that this is a normal process that somebody can go through in processing a divorce." And I bought it. I was like, "Okay, you know, maybe that can happen. If somebody's angry enough," he had claimed that she had cheated on him. "Maybe that was a process, but obviously he didn't do it. And so of course he's not going to do it to me."
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you think about it, really what it was a warning to me that if I leave.
Yeah. You know, the time of the day after the wedding.
Day after I had married him and was pregnant, what was I supposed to do? So you can see how it becomes a, "Oh my God, I'm in this situation. I'm with this guy."
But also for you, if you had some thought of like, "Maybe I should rethink this relationship," the time you're least likely to think that is the day after you just got married.
Correct. And it didn't even enter my head, which is why I think if this was made into a movie, you can really see that progression in a quote character like mine, because there's the naivete at the beginning of not having the language about what abusive relationships look like beyond physical. I didn't know about like kind of the psychological games that he was playing even early on that I either dismissed or he chalked off to joking or.
I think a movie has to be, you know, a movie about your story has to be very good at building both of you up subtly because. Yes.
And it was very subtle. That's the point.
Yeah. Like a movie with a twist ending. Twist endings only work if you can look back and say, "Oh, all the signs were there and I didn't put it together." Like
you can't see the signs.
As a movie audience. And that's exactly what happens in a relationship like this. So you need to have little moments, you know, some of which don't seem like anything at the time, so that when he suddenly comes out with, "I was thinking about killing my ex," like even if it has to be shocking, but not out of character. Like it needs to be.
Correct.
The actor needs to have laid the groundwork for this so that it's not completely out of left field.
Right. And my reaction has to be like not even a beat, because I really didn't have a moment of like, "Oh shit, what did I do?" I really didn't. It was, "Okay, that doesn't sound right." But, and then, "Oh, my therapist said that this is a normal thing." And then I'm like, "Oh, okay." I mean, I'm a different person. He's in love with me. Maybe he wasn't really in love with her. He's in love with me. We're married and now I'm having his child. You know, it's a totally different situation. So it was very easy to sort of gloss over it.
Yeah.
We were living in like off-base housing. So he had this townhouse that he had actually shared with his ex that I moved into when we got together. And housing had opened at the nearby army base where we lived. And he said that he wanted to move us onto the base and it could kind of be a fresh start in a new place that ours. You know, it was a chance to maybe save some money and have our little family there. But what I didn't see was how much it was actually isolating me from my friends and my network that I had built myself independently in the DC area at the time.
Oh,
I had been living there for over a decade. So I had lots of friends, lots of coworkers and colleagues. I had a whole life there before I met him. And moving onto the army base, it was that much further away and made it that much more difficult for me to see the people that were important in my life. He had us really under his thumb. I was working full time, even after I had our son. He was working at the nearby Air Force Base, Andrews. And when I say that he never put in a full day of work, the entire relationship, I mean that. He would go in the morning and he would be back by lunch. He would bring lunch home and he was there all the time. I was never alone. If the military wives on the base had sort of a social gathering just for the wives, if I went, he would be blowing up my phone with texts about the baby, about some, you know, the William being quote sick, or he would always have some reason to be in touch with me. It was constant. He did have a lot of guns. I'm not a person that grew up with guns. I did not grow up around guns, and he had a lot. And you were supposed to, when you moved on the base, check them into like a storage area. You weren't really supposed to have guns in your home. He didn't check them in. We had like two shotguns and many handguns.
That's also a thing where, you know, I'm very, you know, pro gun control and gun safety. Mm-hmm. And if you even sort of breathe a word of gun safety, the backlash is like, oh, you want to take everybody's guns and ban all guns.
I've lived that.
But
yes.
But there's a very important distinction to make between responsible and irresponsible gun owners.
Right.
And you think, oh, who's more responsible than somebody who's had military training?
Right.
And so I can see how that wouldn't have been a red flag that a career, you know, officer has.
Right.
I mean, weapons because they know how to handle them and they know how to be safe with them. And
yes. So when I first met him and he had all the guns, he was single. He didn't have kids. So he didn't have trigger locks or anything on them. And when we first got together and my son, Henry, was 3.5, you know, I did ask that he put trigger locks on them. And he agreed kind of begrudgingly because his thing was if somebody breaks in, he wants to just grab his shotgun from under the bed and blow them away.
Right. The action hero fantasy.
Right. Right. Which he actually enacted one time.
Wow.
He had one of those alarms in the house that sounds like a barking dog.
Yeah.
And randomly in the middle of the night, this was in the townhouse before we moved on the army base, it went off and he was like Rambo. He was completely naked. Jumps up out of bed, grabs the shotgun from under the bed and starts, quote, sweeping the house with the like laser light on it. And it was, I thought it was pretty over the top ridiculous and nobody was there. So he was just showing off, I guess.
Well, I also think a lot of guys just get caught up in the action movie fantasy. And I know,
yeah,
I know a lot of vets and I guess a couple people serving now who are very laid back, very reasonable, and kind of have the attitude of, I know how to handle firearms, do this, you know, as part of my service to my country.
Yeah.
Don't get caught up in it and realistic, but there are a lot of men in and outside of the military who just want to be Liam Neeson.
Yes. And that's what it seemed like, the whole sweeping the house scenario. I'd never seen anything like that before. The other thing that he did after we moved onto the base, and he had the guns in there that he wasn't supposed to have in the house. All the trigger locks, everything went by the wayside because we were that far along in the relationship. And he would take them out and lay them on the bed and take them apart and clean them, quote, I'm putting air quotes, clean them in front of me and play with the laser from the gun on the wall. And knowing that I wasn't comfortable, I did verbalize that I'm not comfortable about guns. And this is before I ever got involved in any sort of gun safety, gun reform stuff. It didn't feel safe that he was doing that. And he would just chuckle and, oh, you're overreacting. I know what I'm doing. But then on the other hand, he would also say things like, you never point a gun at somebody unless you're going to kill them, which I think is interesting given what wound up happening.
Yeah. I mean, and that is a classic sort of positive gun safety thing, meaning don't point guns at somebody.
Right.
But it's very easy for that to take sinister overtones.
Correct. Point. So he had been serving for almost 25 years at that point. He had never seen combat, but he'd served in the Air Force for 25 years. And he was putting in to retire. My parents had moved down to Florida to be near my brother and his wife and family that live down there. And I started talking to my ex about moving down to Florida and being closer to my family. And for whatever reason, he was agreeable to it. So we decided that we were going to build a brand new home and the retirement was going to be forthcoming. And then it came time that we really needed to move, but his retirement hadn't come through. So he said to me that he could basically forge moving orders. He showed me a PDF that had his former station having been in Iraq and that he could change the dates and the location in order to move our stuff down to Florida. And he could like manipulate the PDF. And I was like, well, I don't think that that's really a good idea. And he said, they'll never know. And at that point, there's no talking to him about this. It was like, he was going to do what he wanted to do. And so he did it and he got away with it. Keep in mind, the retirement had not come through.
So was he still serving in DC?
He was still active duty. Like I said, he never worked a full day. We moved down and literally by January, within 3 months, our entire life imploded. New Year's Eve of that year, so 2010, my parents were over. Our neighbors next door were having a pig roast because it's Florida. Okay. And I had gone a little bit between my house and theirs, but he was like manic. He kept going between my house and the neighbor's house, my house and the neighbor's house, and just would not sit still. And at midnight, fireworks went off and he came inside and pulled me aside from my parents. It was like, I shot my gun. I was like, what do you mean you shot your gun? And he said, yeah, I went between the houses. I shot the gun, like between the houses. I was shooting at lizards. How do you respond to these things? It was out of control. Let me backtrack for a second. So my son, Henry, who's my oldest son.
Yeah.
We were on the army base. My ex started making sort of verbal threats about my son, saying that he saw him push the baby, our son, William, yeah, over, that he was, quote, hyperextending his leg, that he was afraid that Henry was going to go into William's nursery and try to kill him. And so he made like this door stopper. It was a block of wood that had nails coming out of it. And he would put it on the inside of the door so you couldn't like push the door in to William's nursery as a way to keep my son Henry out. And he said to me that if Henry hurt the baby, that he would kill him. Okay.
Nice.
So subsequently, I actually sent my son to go live with his father, my ex-husband, my previous husband. It was difficult. I don't get into it very much. It's a lot, but ultimately that decision to do that kept him safe and alive because he wasn't there for a lot of this stuff. But unfortunately, the story I'm about to tell, he actually was there. So January of 2nd, 2011, my ex was in Henry's bedroom. They were playing video games and I was on Facebook. Now, I had not been allowed to be on Facebook in the beginning when Facebook was sort of coming up in like 2008, 2009, when adults were starting to use it because he believed that that would open the door for infidelity, that men would be hitting on me, and I, as if I had no say in this matter. So he would. Finally, I got him to agree. I said that I would, you know, all my family was on, even my parents. And I said, you know, I want to be on it. I'll be friends with my family and, you know, friends that are women, but I won't be friends with men. And he agreed to that. But he said that if a man friended me, that I needed to tell him about it. And so I obliged. And when guys from high school friended me, I would tell him about it. And it would become this big thing. So eventually I stopped telling him. I would just be like, no, it doesn't happen anymore. It doesn't, because it just became a thing every time.
Yeah.
So I was on Facebook. I was on a friend's feed, on a friend's post. And a guy that I went to high school with had commented on it. And it was funny. And I was laughing as I walked into the room and he asked what was funny. And I told him I wasn't hiding anything.
Right.
And he proceeded to escalate. He picked a fight with me. He left the house in our car and blew up my phone for the next like 5 hours. saying things like that he was drunk and that he was at a strip club and he was surrounded by so many hot women. And I, you know, I was like, do not come home. Like, do not come home. If you're going to be like this, if you're this drunk, don't come home. Well, he didn't listen to me and he came in. I heard the garage door open. I was sitting on the couch. He walked in and he went like right into the master bedroom and closed and locked the door. And so I went to the door and I was like, I mean, I wasn't like crazy. I just was knocking on it saying, you know, can we talk? And I heard, ch-ch-ch. And so I, you know, the sound, you know, that sound when you hear it, right? So I thought in my head, I mean, keep in mind, both kids, the baby was in, William was in his crib. Henry was in his room. I'm standing in front of the master bedroom door. The front door was across the house. So I was like, I'm going to run outside because if he shoots me, I want people to hear it. That literally was what I thought. I don't know. I didn't want to be killed in the house and nobody would hear. So I ran out front and I was calling 911. And next thing you know, our garage door opens and he comes out holding William, our baby. And he gets into the front seat of the car and puts William on his lap. I mean, and that's that moment. Like I, you know, he was getting in the car with William. Henry was asleep in the house. I didn't know what to do. I jumped in the car and I was on with 911 and I was saying, please just give me the baby, leave the baby out of it. Just give me the baby. He pulled back out of the driveway, went flying up the street and raised his fist. So this was the first time, and I think this is important in the story, is that this was the first time that he actually threatened to be physical. All the way up until this, it was the power and control and the psychological abuse and the emotional abuse and the isolation and all of that kind of stuff. This was the first time that he actually raised his fist. And
everything leading up to it feels like it's on a whole other level.
Right.
The going out and, you know, berating you from the strip.
Oh, and, yes. You know, like, this was.
And cocking the gun. Like that's
like nothing. I had never experienced anything like this before in my entire life. Ever, 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 ever. So you can imagine my thoughts and my feelings in this because I didn't know what the hell was going on. I didn't know what to do. These were all just split second decisions based on zero experience.
I would imagine that when you're with somebody who is prone to having smaller blowups before that, there's got to be a certain baseline of anxiety, not knowing when those are going to come. And so then when it gets that much worse.
Yeah. You know, he would do little things like, you know, leave the room and go upstairs and refuse to talk to me, the silent treatment type of stuff. And
right.
But it wasn't this.
Well,
it wasn't
sure,
to this level. So he raised his fist and said, if you don't get out of this fucking car right now, I'm going to punch you in your fucking face. And I bailed out the door. And then he went just tearing up the street and around the corner. And he still had William. He still had the baby.
Yeah.
So I'm in my neighborhood in the middle of the street. I see him stop and put his brake lights on. And then I see the reverse lights.
Yeah.
So I jumped into some bushes that were right nearby. I didn't want him to find me. I don't even know how I thought about any of this, but that's what I did. I hid. He didn't see me. So then he drove away again and drove around the corner. So I started running like up the block, screaming at the top of my lungs. It's like 2 a.m. when I saw houses with lights on, I was going up knocking on doors. If I saw cars in the driveway, knowing people, not one person came out, not one person opened a window. Nobody did anything. Nobody did any, and I was screaming at the top of my lungs. There's no way, not one neighbor heard, but nobody did anything. So I had the thought that like, okay, well, nobody's going to help me. So and then I thought, Henry, I got to get back. I thought Tom had taken, who knew where he was. I had no idea where he went. So my thought was get back there. Hopefully the police are there and I need to be there for Henry. And I run up, the cops are there and there he is in the driveway. And he had these military coins that they have. So military units have their team coins and they'll trade coins. And it's this whole thing. He was coining these cops and talking about how he was this military veteran and that his scars and his injuries and showing them were from being in a Humvee explosion in Iraq, which didn't happen. It was fiction. So he's all cool and calm, giving them coins. And I run up. I'm a mess, traumatized. I didn't know what. So you can imagine what they thought, right? So one cop did pulled me inside and was like, he didn't hit you this time. He'll hit you next time. I've seen this enough. You need to go get a restraining order. And then, is there anywhere that you and the kids can stay tonight? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, he has nowhere to go. So do you have somewhere you can go? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, my parents live nearby. Call them. So I called my parents screaming. So that's like the first phone call they ever got of me screaming, come get me, come get me.
Yeah.
They had to walk up, like drive up on the scene. None of us had ever seen anything like this before. They had to take me and the boys to their house. He got to stay in the house. Go get a hotel. You have money. You go with it. Why did I have to leave? No, I had to leave and wake both kids up. So
it sounded like he had charmed one of the cops. What if he charmed them both?
All of them. There was more than one, and he charmed all of them. I remember one said to me something about him in Iraq, and I was like, what are you talking about? He was never even in Iraq. He's lying. And the guy looked at me like, what? And like, what are you talking about? They believed him. Ridiculous. So, but you know, I'm in the middle of it and I'm not going to, told him and that was it. So my parents took us home, and Henry actually had a flight out to go back to his dad's that morning. So I hadn't slept, and his flight was at like 7 a.m.
Oh man.
So my dad, I was cold everywhere, shaking, couldn't stop crying. And I had to go put this child on a plane.
And then say goodbye to your son for.
And then say goodbye to my son, which every time, oh my God. I mean, it's awful. It was awful.
Oh, at that, so, when my kids were that age, just like going out to the grocery store was like an emotional goodbye.
Right. Never mind. I'm putting you on a plane and, you know, I'll see you in a couple months. I can't. So I just did it. I got it together. I mean, I didn't get it together. I'm definitely a mess the entire time at the airport getting him on that plane, but I got him on that plane and got him out of there. And then from there, my dad and I literally left the airport and went to the Broward County courthouse to go get a restraining order. Nobody tells you what that entails. You say you want to get a restraining order. They hand you all this paperwork that I didn't know. I've never done this before. I didn't know if I was checking the right box. I'm traumatized. I was still shaking.
And sleep deprived.
And so we go back and wait, and there's other women in there. Some of them have little small children with them sitting in this room waiting to know whether the judge is going to grant this or not. Mine was granted. It was a temporary restraining order. And they gave me a packet and they said, you keep this on you at all times in case he violates it. So you have a copy of everything that you'll need. This other packet goes to the police station. They have to serve him. They called us when they were going to serve him.
Okay.
So we were actually in the car nearby our house, my dad and I, when they served him. And I saw his BMW come up the street and start to turn toward our house. And he saw the cops and then he sped off down the street. He tried to avoid them.
Oh, yeah.
And they actually wound up. They caught him. They were able to serve him, but they didn't do anything about it that he tried to speed up. So keep in mind that this happened. He was served the restraining order, but he was also active duty. The entire time that we were in Florida, he was active duty. And his superior officer thought he was in Virginia. He had no idea that Tom had moved down to Florida.
So nobody knows he wasn't showing up for work.
It was like, September to January. He never went then. At that point, he never went in the office once. He knew he was in trouble once he was served.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Because he wasn't where he was supposed to be. So he basically fled the area.
So there's a record that he's in Florida now.
Right. He fled the area and went back up to Virginia. While he was doing that, I emailed his superior officer with the restraining order and said, listen, your soldier did this. And just so you know, he's been down in Florida since September. I got a call from that guy, and he was very victim blamey. He was very trying to cover his ass, you know?
Because it comes on him that his, one of his...
His head was going to roll.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But I reported it, and there was really nothing he could do about it. So what ensued there was that they wound up holding him at the Air Force base for about 3 months or so, January to March. And I reported the fraud. So the PDF that he had submitted to get our stuff moved.
Yeah, yeah.
And I reported the abuse.
Right.
And that triggered an investigation by the Office of Special Investigations, OSI, which is basically like the FBI for the military.
Right.
I got contacted by them. They came and seized our computer. I gave full statements. They did an entire, you know, they must have interviewed him, interviewed his superiors, did a whole 3 month investigation. By March, I got a call from my contact at OSI, and he said that they had completed their investigation, that he was guilty for fraud and spousal abuse, and that they were recommending a court-martial to his superiors. But here's the cute thing about the military is that his superiors can decide what to do with it. They don't have to court-martial just because he was found guilty. OSI asked for a court-martial, and his superiors declined to court-martial him and said that they were going to handle it administratively instead, and that they were going to retire him immediately.
Wow, I had no idea that's how the military justice system works.
I actually testified in front of Congress about this very thing.
Wow.
Because when I spoke with the OSI officer, I was like, what are you talking about? I mean, he's found guilty.
Yeah.
How does that? Nope. His commanding officers can make the choice about what to do with him. They retired him with his pension and a slap on the wrist. Nothing happened to him. He completely got away with it. His commanding officer called me. She called me on the phone. I started crying. I was like, he's dangerous. I'm begging you, don't let him go. I've reported him. He's going to be angry. He's going to come after me. We're not safe. You have to do something about it. No, we're retiring him.
The police, the courts, and the United States military courts have all, you know, it wasn't like nobody knew about this guy, what he was going to be capable of.
They all knew about everybody.
You could talk about and did everything you could do.
I blasted it to everybody that I needed to blast it to.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody cared. Probably they didn't believe me. The military just wanted him out of their hair. Actually, he went AWOL more than once when they held him on the Air Force base. We got a call from his commanding officer during the time they were supposed to be holding him that he had gotten out.
So he went AWOL while being held for going AWOL?
Yes. And that my family and I should go to a hotel. And we did.
Oh my God.
They said that he had gone to Walter Reed and had checked himself in for like mental something. But they were covering. They lost him.
Yeah, yeah.
So he got out and, I had the restraining order. In the meantime, we had to keep going back to court in Broward County, family court judge, about the temporary restraining order. I had started proceedings for the divorce, but that was really dragging because the restraining order seemed to be the top priority. The judge kept bringing us back and bringing us back. I kept asking for a permanent restraining order. They would not give it to me.
And how long is the temporary one? Like how often do you have to keep renewing this?
It was every few months.
So you're basically never out of court for very long. And just like the house, it's kind of all on you to do.
It was on me to do everything. And he did things during the time he was under the temporary restraining order. He created like a fake Facebook account and tried to friend request me and talk to me that way.
Yeah.
He sent a pack of creepy cards. Like loving cards and but he addressed it to himself, knowing that I was expecting a child support check and that I would open it and see the cards. When I called the police on that as a violation, they said, well, he addressed it to himself. So it's not, it was every excuse not to do anything about it.
There's so much like implied goodwill towards somebody who has no reason to deserve it.
Yep. I think because he looked how he looked and he was military, I think he was given 1, 2, 3, 1,000 chances.
Yeah, yeah.
If I had a nickel for every time I heard from some form of authority that he presents so well, he just presents so well. Yeah. He seems like such a good guy. He seems like such a good father. It makes me want to throw up, honestly, because I knew and nobody would listen. Nobody would listen. And then the summer hit and my parents were snowbirds at the time. They were my main support system. My parents are incredible. They were incredible through this entire thing. They left to come back up to Massachusetts. And I was in Florida, like kind of by myself with William. And I fell into a really bad spot. You know, I couldn't afford the life that we had created. The mortgage wasn't being paid. My car had been repossessed. I was in credit card debt from credit cards that we took out in my name in order to furnish the new home.
Yeah, yeah.
I was making half the salary in Florida that I was making up in Virginia. I think I was making like, you know, $51,000 a year. My son was in preschool. That was, you know, $1,200 a month. Plus the more, like I was drowning financially. So that's a whole financial abuse angle to the story as well.
And it's hard to support two kids in a household when you're, you know, when you have a supportive spouse and two incomes.
Right. I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't make the house payments. We paid what, 3 months of the house, of a brand new house. And then it wasn't being paid. I was just in a really bad, vulnerable spot.
Well, and then you had been traumatized on top of all that. And you had to deal with the courts and.
Correct. So unfortunately, I'll throw out this statistic. So it takes a woman 7 to 9 times to actually leave her abuser. There can be a lot of back and forth, breaking up and getting back together, right. Even when there's physical abuse, even, you know, and there's many, many, many reasons that
when you have a child together, it's harder when your finances are tied together. There's correct. All sorts of reasons.
So we wound up communicating again that summer. So, you know, July, August. And he claimed to be out in Seattle working for a government contractor and making really big money. You know, he really wanted William and me to come out there. And I said that, like, I didn't really trust him and, you know, everything that had happened and that I was still really kind of freaked out about it. And of course, he made all the promises. You know, I this isn't what I want. I want our family to be together. I want us, you know, to be together for William. I have my pension. I'm making really good money as a contractor. You can quit your job. You can, you know, stay at home and raise William. What if I come back to Florida and we try to see how it goes? And, you know, maybe we can come back to Seattle. And so I did. I fell back. It's so hard for me because I'm just, you know.
No, of course. But I mean, apart from anything else, when you're drowning financially, it's very tempting to have.
Right. And I don't want to make it sound like it was all about money because part of it was to
kind of rebuild the life that you had.
Right.
Which again, on the surface was good and to have.
Right. And the whole time, all I wanted was to be together with him and have this life and, you know, have our family. That's what I wanted, you know?
No, of course. So, and I also, you know, this is somebody that you loved or married to, and there's some, you know, very deep instinct to give that person another chance.
And just to, you know,
want things to be back to normal.
I just want things to be back to normal again. And, you know, when we were talking about that night, it was, here's the thing. It was, well, things got out of control. We both did things that we probably regret and I actually had done nothing.
Right.
It really was all him, but it was, oh, this was overblown. I overreacted, you know, it was just, you know, my jealousy and I just, that kind of stuff. And it was easy for me to just say, okay, well, yeah, because really it was the first time that something like that had happened. So it was easy for me to say, okay, well, things were pretty good before. And then all of a sudden this happened and maybe it was just like a really bad night and whatever. So I went against my gut and I don't want to say that I jumped back in head first. I definitely didn't. I went in thinking I had like some sort of control and some sort of boundaries, and I wasn't going in blind.
Right.
I definitely didn't trust him when he came back, but he did come back. And then it felt like we just kind of did go back to normal again. I was still working. I never stopped working all of this time, but then it all fell apart again about 6 weeks later, 2 months later. One night, William was sick. He seemed to have, I don't know, he just couldn't go to sleep. He wasn't feeling well. I was up with him for a good chunk of the night till maybe 1 or 2 in the morning. And then I went and woke up my ex and was like, you know, can you take over for a little bit? Cause I have to work in the morning. Let me just get a few hours sleep.
And
he said, fine, no problem. He got up. I fell asleep. A few hours later, I remember it was about 4 in the morning. I woke up and I heard William's voice. Like I just heard him still up, you know?
Right.
And I was like, oh man, he really. So I went into his bedroom and I turned on the light, and William sat up in his bed and then like projectile vomited onto his bed. And so I thought, oh good, you know, maybe he'll feel better now. That's probably why he couldn't sleep. He had an upset stomach. And I was like, come here, baby, you know, come on. He got up off the bed. And when he got on the floor, he was like reaching out in front of him.
Like
he was reaching for something and like almost hallucinating. And immediately I looked at my ex and was like, what'd you give him? I don't know what instinct, I don't know what mother thing was happening there, but I knew I had never seen my child act like that before. And I was scared. And he said, oh, I gave him Motrin. And I said, how much? And when we went in the bathroom, he showed me, you know, the little Motrin.
The little plastic cup.
He pointed to like the top one, which Will was 2. So that would have been, you know, way more than he was supposed to.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, well, we need to call 911 because he's not acting right. And he was hesitant. And I screamed at him finally, like, fucking call 911. And they passed him to poison control. But what I didn't know was that because of the previous domestic violence that had happened at our home, our house was flagged. So that triggered something to send a sheriff over. So when the paramedics came, a sheriff was there. And the paramedics were checking him. And they started saying, you know, he seems okay. Well, the sheriff was like, I don't know. I think we should take him to the hospital. And so I was like, okay. So I rode in the ambulance with William. Tom followed us, paramedics and the sheriff followed us. They checked Will at the hospital. They took his blood. We still don't know what he was given. He was definitely given something, but it came back okay. But while we were in the room, the sheriff was at the nurse's station and he caught my eye, like kind of waved me over subtly. So I was like, okay. So I went over and I remember looking back and seeing Tom kind of watching me. And the sheriff said under his breath, is everything okay? And I was like, no. Like, I knew. I was like, no, it's not. And he said, okay, well, when you get released, you're going to go home and a child protective services agent's going to be there and we're going to get you out. We get in the car, Tom, me and Will, and he starts laying into me about that I had made like too big a deal of this. And now it's like he sensed something. He's like, now we, you know, we might be in trouble and whatever. Right, and I was like, no, it's fine. We get home. As he said, a child services agent was there. She was incredible, like incredible. She, no nonsense. She separated us like she was supposed to do, took me aside and was like, you need to pack a bag for yourself. You need to pack a bag for your son. You need to go to your parents. If I hear that you're back with him, I'm coming to take your child. And I was like, okay. That's all I need to hear. That's all I need to hear. It was almost like a relief.
It was like somebody's, you know, giving you permission to do what you
correct.
Need to do.
And that it was off of my plate to be the one to say, right. Like she gave me the permission and empowered me to say, okay. And like, she had to go talk to him and be like, I'm telling them to leave.
And what really struck me, you were talking about being in court with the restraining order and how the paperwork's confusing. Nobody's helping you. And like, the staff does 20 of these a day and you've never done this before.
Right.
They should be the ones guiding you through the process. So
they don't do
the child protective services, like she does this all the time. This is her career.
Exactly.
So that's exactly what she should do is, I know the situation well. You don't, I'm going to take the lead. I'm going to lead you through
this. And
I
had not had that. So I did it. I packed a bag. We went to my parents. And then what I'll say about that situation that I subsequently found out was that one of the officers that was involved in the previous domestic violence. And he was also one that responded when the creepy cards arrived. Yeah. He had my ex pegged. He's one of the few that did. So when the 911 call came in for William, he was behind on the phone with the sheriff saying, stay on them, stay on them. I don't trust this guy, stay on them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was behind getting the correct child services agent to our house.
Right, right.
I had kind of two guardian angels there. So we left. I didn't have a restraining order at that time. The temporary had expired. They told me to go get another one. I did, on behalf of myself and my son. The judge turned it down, even though we had gone to the hospital and there were charges against my ex from Child Protective Services. So CPS did bring charges against my ex, and that set off a whole other thing in court with what they call down in Florida dependency court on behalf of children.
Right.
Set like a 10-step program that my ex was going to have to do in order to gain unsupervised visits, including, you know, a drug screening, anger management, like bullshit, anger management, parenting classes, and that sort of stuff. Doesn't do anything to help somebody that's a psychopath.
Right.
But he was going to have to do all of these things. That would stretch out for another almost year, 9 months. He again bailed back up to Virginia after the William incident.
Right, right, right.
So he was not in the area, but he would fly down every so often throughout those 9 months to do supervised visits with William, with a supervisor that he had chosen, who he had completely snowed. During that time, child services would come to my home and look at my house and William's room and bed and look in my refrigerator and make sure that there was food in the refrigerator. Keep in mind, I had no charges against me.
Yeah, yeah.
I was being visited by Child Protective Services and they weren't really pushing his program on him. As we pushed up on 9 months of this, he had barely done any of the steps he was supposed to do. And they were pressuring me to close the case. They just wanted to close the case. They said that he presents so well and they've seen him interact with his son and he's such a good father. And so I remember as we were coming close to closing the case, it wasn't the CPS agent, but it was a caseworker, I guess, who I had interacted with a lot through those 9 months. She said, do you think that William's in danger from him? And I said, well, I don't know that he would hurt him per se, but I'm the target and he's with me all the time. So, but you don't think he would hurt him? They just wanted that answer.
Right.
They didn't care about me. Right. So we go to the final hearing for that. We had this female magistrate who is an absolute bitch. Horrible, horrible, horrible woman. I had a lawyer with me. At that point, we still didn't have a case in family court. We had no visitation schedule in place. Everything had gotten put on hold because of this dependency court and charges. She just wants to close it. I knew hell was going to break loose. He could do whatever he wanted. So we were like, can you just please, please set even just a temporary visitation schedule that's signed? No, that has to be done by family court. And by the way, I feel bad for this child with you two as parents. Again,
God,
I had done nothing
at
all. None of this was against me. So I was blamed by this woman.
And another thing that strikes me, kind of the same thing with the military, finding him guilty and then not prosecuting him, is that you have this terrific cop watching your case and keeping an eye on you. You've got this terrific CPS agent who does exactly the right thing and helps you. It only takes one person for the whole thing to fall down.
The judge.
Yeah. Also if the cop hadn't taken an interest, then that sheriff doesn't know to red flag your husband. If he sends a different CPS agent, maybe that person is less helpful. Like somebody going above and beyond, then the whole thing falls apart. And there have to be countless women for whom things were different and it did unfold
differently.
And if we're going to start talking about this as a movie, we've had a lot of movies about abuse that were essentially thrillers. But I feel like this is more, it's your personal story. It's the story of this relationship, but so much of it is about the system and how it doesn't work. It's almost more of like an Aaron Brockovich kind of story than like,
I'm not kidding.
Judd has to get out of her bad relationship movie. Yeah. You know,
I have long said that this story is way more than the abusive relationship itself and ultimately the shooting. This story is a story about how systems that are put into place in this country that are supposed to protect women and children fail across the board. You see it time and time and time again, and I'm just one story of this.
Oh, sure.
All right, I'm almost to the big part. Right. Okay. So Child Protective Services case closes. We have no visitation schedule in place. We make a verbal agreement in the courthouse hallway with him, his lawyer, me, and my lawyer that like an every other weekend and whatever, but nothing's written in. You know, there's nothing holding this. I wanted him to wait an extra weekend because, I mean, my son hadn't really seen him that much. They really didn't have like that close of a relationship. I'm the one that was here for him the whole time. Nope. He demanded to have that first weekend. I said, you know, can you just kind of be chill, just stay in the area? Nope. I'm taking him to Disney. So he did. He took William to Disney the very first weekend. And I actually didn't know if that's where they were. I didn't know if he would return. I had nothing in writing.
Yeah, because the worry is he could take him to Seattle. Like,
right, exactly.
At this point, there's nothing stopping him.
That weekend, a couple of things. I remember he sent me a picture of William holding a bag of candy, and it looked like hotel curtains behind him.
Okay.
And he has this strained, scared look on his face, William. And he sent it to me and he's like, LOL, LOL in the text. And I was like, what is happening? I mean, I showed it to my mother. My mother screamed. And my mother's very.
Yeah.
She screamed and was like, call the cops. And I was like, there's literally nothing I can do. And then he texted me over that weekend saying that he was going out. So that he was supposed to be in Disney. He got some babysitter and he was going out that night. I was like, why don't you spend the time with your son that you haven't seen?
No, I'm going out.
I got a babysitter. You know, he was just like fucking with me.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I mean, it was all emotional because he wanted me to lose my mind. Didn't know if he would return. He did. So the next few weeks from that, a lot of texting and emailing from him, threatening custody, saying that he was going to take William away from me, that he made more money than I do, and that he's also got his pension, so he doesn't really have to work. And so he can stay home and the courts are going to side with him. And, you know, I'm not going to really see him. I'm not really going to see my son. So there was a lot of that going on. Then I was at work. I got a call from the Child Protective Services investigator. My ex had called in a false child abuse report on me. On my son, saying that there were bruises all over him. That investigator, it's like another miraculous thing, was on duty. She, I don't know if she intercepted the call or she saw him too. She knew what he was. She called me at work and was like, Kate, he's called in an allegation. I know he's full of shit, but go pick up Will at school. I'll meet you at your parents' house. She showed up with a female sheriff and she did the obligatory look and obviously William was fine. She said to me, like, what's going on? What happened? So I told her about the end of the CPS hearing and how we don't have. And she said, well, wait, when they closed it, are you primary guardian or whatever, the primary? And I said, yeah. And she said, nope, he's not going to see him until there's a visitation schedule and a custody order signed by a judge. I will tell him that. You do not have to send William with him. I was like, are you serious?
I'm not going to get in trouble. Nobody thought to tell you
that before. Right. No. They could have told me that at the end of that hearing, but nobody told me anything. So she was like, nope. You don't have to send him. I like cried my eyes out. Contacted my attorney, said what she had said. She tried to interact with his attorney. He didn't respond. Everything goes silent for a week. I had actually moved into a new apartment like that week. I had not given him the address. I picked an apartment that had a gate. I was trying to stay safe, trying to stay, you know, where he couldn't find us.
Yeah.
So November 2nd, 2012, I came home, went to Will's preschool, picked him up like I always do. I had dinner plans that night. I was going to drop William off at my parents' neighbors, who I'm like dear, dear friends with. They're like family. So I was going to drop him off. They were going to watch him. I was going out to dinner. Fine. So I go back to my apartment, freshen up, I think I made him some grilled cheese. He was watching Spider-Man, ready to go. I go out to my car, turn it on, and a lot of the alert lights come on the dashboard.
Right.
So low tire pressure. Keep in mind, in one of the times that he had violated the restraining order, he had let the air out of my tires in the driveway and slashed my father's tire.
You must have
so immediately when those came on and it said low tire pressure, I was like, oh, shit. You know, I just knew. Because anything weird like that happened, he was behind.
Yeah, yeah.
So turn the car off, go around, look at the tires. And I get to the passenger side front and I see a big flash in it. And I was like, shit, he found me, you know? Yeah. So I called the guy I was dating at the time. He knew kind of what was going on. I told him, dinner's off. Like, you know, this is going on. I called my dad and he said, okay, call roadside assistance, have them come change the tire, also call 911. And I said, well, I mean, I don't have a restraining order, so they're probably not going to do anything anyway. And he said, well, you know, go ahead and call them anyway. So I did. My dad showed up in the meantime, and then the cop showed up, and my dad stayed in the apartment with my son. I went out to the cop, young female, told her what had been happening, that I didn't have a restraining order. And she said, well, I'm sorry. There's really nothing I can do.
Yeah.
Go tomorrow to the courthouse. The domestic violence department's open. Go get a restraining order. I said, well, I've already been turned down for three, so I don't think that that's going to help. And she was like, well, I'm just really sorry. And she gave me a card with kind of a case number on it because she was going to have to write a report anyway. And as she was leaving, I said, he's going to have to kill me before you people do anything about him. And she left. Didn't ask for his description, didn't ask to see a picture, didn't ask about his car, didn't drive around even the grounds, just as a courtesy.
Yeah.
So fine, she leaves. I go back in to the apartment and my dad's like, okay. And I had also called roadside and he said, well, I'm going to go back home. Again, their house was like a mile and a half from me. Wait for roadside, we'll change tire. Then you and William come and like to our house, we'll figure out what we're going to do. He goes to leave and walks out the door. I'm at the door. So from my front door of the apartment, the parking lot was to the left and my car was right there. And my dad turns around and is like, Katie, call 911. Tom is here. And when I looked over, I saw his BMW backed up in the parking spot next to my car and like the dome light came on. So my dad said, call 911. I'm going to wait here. And I said, no, I had a bad feeling. I didn't want my dad was like 67, 68 at that point. I didn't want him having to
like an altercation
deal with this guy. Right. Yeah. So I was like, no, you know, just come in and we'll do it. So by the time my dad got in, my ex had gotten to the door and he was pushing against it. And my dad and I were on the other side of the door, pushing back just to keep him out. And my dad was trying to like lock the door. So he couldn't get in. And then we heard three blasts. When we were pushing against the door, we didn't even know that he had a gun. We didn't know until the blasts came through the door. At that point, it's like tunnel vision plus slow motion plus fast motion. It's very hard to describe. I remember backing up, obviously, and screaming. And I was on with 911, by the way.
Also, while this is happening.
While it was happening, I was on with 911. At that point in 2012, the system was really bad. They couldn't pinpoint exactly where I was. Like back then, I think it was like you needed to call from a landline, right?
Oh,
so
right.
She kept asking my address over and over again, and I had just moved there. And I'm,
yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Right. So I backed up, and my dad went like the other way across the room. And keep in mind that my son was like right behind us when the bullets came through. So any of them could have hit him, but they didn't. So I backed up. He came in. He was pointing the gun and boom, that went through my right hand. Okay. So it just like blew up in front of me. I remember backing up toward the kitchen and I went to like hit the ground and, you know, I brought my hand back, you know, like that. And it was like splatter up the wall. And I just like laid down. I was screaming, begging for my life. And you know what's crazy? Oh, you know what's crazy is that it's not like when he came in, he was saying like, I love you so much. I just want us to be a family. If I can't have you, nobody can. I just, you know, I miss my son, anything like that. He was saying, why'd you take my stuff? Why did you take my stuff? Because I had moved into the apartment and had taken some of the furniture from the house. That's what he was saying. I was like screaming and saying, I'll give it back. I'll give it back. Don't do this. Don't do this. Then he went over to my dad, who I subsequently found out was also trying to call 911, but he had like an older phone. So he didn't have a smartphone.
It kept shutting off
and he couldn't get through. My ex yelled at him to hang up the phone and push it away. And then boom, like I heard boom and I heard my dad grunt and I thought he had killed my dad.
Oh God.
Yeah. So then he came back over to me. We had kind of a bistro table. So it was higher up and like benches, you know, around the table. And I was on the other side. I had crawled in my own blood from like right by the kitchen around the bistro table. And he was on the other side of the table standing next to William and he knelt down next to William. And then he pointed the gun at me and had like, you know, the laser on it and was like playing, like taunting me and playing with the gun. And then Will all of us, keep in mind, my son was 4 years old.
Yeah.
Yelled, don't do it, daddy. Don't shoot mommy. Like I remember that clear as day. He remembers it. My father heard it.
Oh my God.
And all of a sudden it got quiet. And I always, when I'm interviewed, I will always say that there, I will not give him that he had a change of heart. He had peeked out at one point and knew that all the cops were there. I don't know why it got quiet, but William said those words. I heard him kind of go back into the kitchen area, which was behind where I was. And he said, Kate, there's a table runner on the table. Grab that and wrap the wound. And so I just listened and I did it, which that was later used in evidence because it was soaked.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said, Kate, just go. And when I looked up, keep in mind, this is all in all about 18 to 20 minutes. No cops kicked in the door. Nobody was coming in to save us. So I was like, okay, I was not doing well. I was not doing well. I knew that it was really, really bad for me. So I didn't want to just lay there, yeah. You know? And so I said, okay, well, so I'm going to get up. And if he shoots me, you know, in the back of the head as I'm leaving, that's what's going to happen. But I'm going to go. So I got up and I ran out. I collapsed on the grass. I saw basically like the entire police department in the parking lot, all the, you know, the lights, and I could see them kind of, you know, behind their doors, guns, and they're like, ma'am, can you get over to us? And I was like, no, I'm dying. God, somebody come get me. They wouldn't. And maybe like a minute or two later, my father came out with William in front of him. So that was the first time my dad thought I was dead.
And
I thought he was dead.
Yeah.
So
oh my God.
When he got out with William, that was the first time that we both knew that we were both at least at that point still alive and that William was okay. Like not, he hadn't gotten hit at all. So my dad came out, the cops are like, you know, sir, he has the quote better than I do, but it was something like, sir, can you bring her with you? So my dad was also, I mean, he was gravely hurt too.
Yeah.
And so he is like, Katie, we got to go. We got to go get up. We got to go. And I just held on to him, got up. He got us to safety, got us on the other side of the cop cars. And we laid down on the ground. And I remember laying there and hearing my dad screaming, Katie, 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 because he thought I was dying. He really thought I was dying.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I kept waiting to hear like the kill shot for my ex that they got him.
Right. Right.
I never heard it. And the other thing was that they realized once I was on the ground that not only had my hand been hit, but that I had been shot in the chest on the left. Like,
oh God.
So by my heart. And I didn't even know. I didn't even know that that had happened. I just thought my hand had been hit.
Well, that's what's bleeding.
Right, I was also bleeding profusely. So the reason my clothes were bloody all over was because of my chest wound, not my hand.
Oh, wow.
Because I was bleeding profusely from my chest. The other thing I remember is that the female cop that had left that had said, sorry, there's nothing we can do, go get a restraining order, was standing over me saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And I was screaming, I fucking told you people that he was going to fucking do this and nobody would listen to me. None of you believe me. I was freaking out. But then it was like, I also remember just kind of, I never lost consciousness, but I was struggling. And it was determined that I had to get choppered out and that my dad could go via ambulance. My dad was able to get through to my mother, who got the call, who got that horrible call.
Oh God, yeah.
That Tom shot us. She called my brother, who like slumped against the wall and like, you know, like, so it's like this ripple effect on the family, right? So my mom and brother sped to the hospital. You know, my mother had to watch me coming out of the air in the helicopter.
Yeah.
You know, seeing her. So it was like three generations of her family affected.
Right.
Nobody knew where William was. The cops had taken him to the police station, but nobody knew where he was.
Oh my God.
He was questioned at the police station by a forensic detective. He was 4 years old. He had no shoes on and had soiled himself, and like nobody bothered to change him. And so both my dad and I had to have surgeries the very next morning. I had to have surgery on my hand. My dad had been shot in his left arm, and he had also been shot in his, the shot I had heard, he was shot point blank in his left side. So it had, it didn't hit any vital organs, but they had to take the bullet out.
Well, of course.
So he was in ICU. For me, the chest wound was just a flesh wound. The bullet went in one side of my breast and out the other.
God.
So it just missed my heart. Had I been turned any other way, I probably would have died.
Yeah.
That it went in and out is, they were like, I remember they had like an X, this big X-ray machine. And I remember them yelling, it's a flesh wound. It's a flesh wound. There was no bullet in my chest, and I wound up not even needing stitches. Wow. I mean, it was ugly, but it healed on its own.
How did your son cope with this?
I mean, he was four. They sent in a child trauma team the day after, and he was put with a child psychologist who specialized in trauma. That, you know, they worked with him. I think at the beginning it was like twice a week. They told us that he saw the whole thing. Don't change the story of what happened. Don't lie to him about it. Don't sweep it under the rug. Don't pretend it didn't happen. Don't tell him that it didn't happen the way he remembers. Our instinct. That was our instinct anyway. But I think that there are people that, you know, it's like they feel shame about what happened and they just want to like pretend it didn't happen. But
or even you don't want your child to have to relive that.
Right.
You know, the trauma.
But the fact that he was there, they were very much like, you know, answer his questions. Don't change it. Don't pretend. Don't make it shameful.
Yeah, and that's the way that, with your kid. That's
right. And that's the way we approached it the whole time. So for him, his trauma has come out in a lot of ways of just being like very overly protective of me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And worried that something's going to happen to me or I'm not going to come back, which you would expect, but it's more than a child should
of course.
Worry about. Like their parent, you know, children that haven't experienced this obviously don't do that. But
yeah.
He's very, very protective of me even to this day, very sort of vigilant when we're out in public looking around, like kind of eyeing people up,
right,
seeing if anybody looks dangerous, that sort of thing. But he's incredible. He's doing great.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear. And then what happened to your ex?
So no, they didn't shoot him on the scene.
Yeah.
He surrendered peacefully. He left the gun and the extra ammunition that he had brought with him on the counter, came out. They arrested him on the scene. He waited in jail for four and a half years. It's like a whole nother part of the movie is the trial and the re-traumatization that happened to my family. As a result of this, we were told right from the start that he would have more rights than we did as victims. And they were right. Continuance after continuance, we wound up having a mistrial because the jury didn't do what they were supposed to do. And they talked amongst themselves about what they had heard in court. So we had this hanging over us after being shot for another almost 4.5 years, wondering if a crazy, you know, Florida jury is let him off. And then when with the military thing and him always getting up,
right.
Everything that had been my experience the entire time was that the military let him off. Authorities always, you know, didn't believe me or thought that he was fine. And
yeah.
I mean, it was a lot of anxiety around that time. Ultimately, we went to trial in February of 2017. The most serious charges were premeditated attempted first degree murder for my dad and me. And then there were some, you know, lesser charges, but he was found guilty on all. And then the sentencing was a couple months later and he got 60 years in prison. And at that point he was, what, 50, 51? So that's the rest of his life.
Yeah.
It's basically a life sentence without saying it's a life sentence. But he was smug, glib, and then blank through the whole thing.
Yeah.
He didn't care. Yeah. So.
I hate to even put, you know, this personal trauma into movie terms, but it's such a character arc from the charming, you know, handsome guy
who has been
on dates in the beginning to like, just
a, laid, a full just, blown, yes.
Just laid bare at the end, this is who he is.
Full blown psychopath. Like at the beginning, when I was learning about what I had been through and learning about emotional abuse and all of that, I saw it clearly, but a lot of that led into learning about personality disorders, and you can't, you know, there's no medicine for that. You can't cure somebody that's like that. And that's exactly what he was. He met every characteristic of a socio/psychopath.
Yeah.
He Googled husband killing wife. That's why it was premeditated, because he had looked into it. Like, this was something that he planned to do. He's a psychopath.
Yeah.
He wanted to do this, and he didn't care that my dad was there. He didn't care that his own son was there. He wanted me dead. The defense tried to say it was involuntary intoxication based on some medication that he had been prescribed. They tried to bring in, quote, PTSD from his military service, but he had never served. The jury wasn't buying it. Thank God.
I was going to say.
So then from that point, from my hospital bed, I decided that I was going to tell this story anywhere and everywhere that I could. I was angry. I was so angry that everybody that had a chance at each point didn't do something. It did not need to get to this point. It was preventable. He could have been stopped in so many ways.
It's such a depressingly familiar story.
It is. And that it took attempted murder and could have been the death of three family members for the systems and the authorities to then swing into action. After the shooting, we got permanent restraining orders against him. Well, he was already in jail. But thanks. After the shooting, they revoked his parental rights to my son. Well, he has no parental rights to my son.
Exactly what you said to the cop. They're not going to do anything until he kills me.
Right.
You know, he was a couple inches away from actually doing that.
So this is reactive. Everything was reactive, not proactive. He could have been stopped in any of those scenarios that I've described. But no, he presents so well, and he's military, and you know,
even if the military had held him accountable, maybe things would have turned out differently at all.
It could have been stopped right there. So I turned what happened to me into a platform to raise awareness and, you know, do some activism and advocacy around violence against women and gun reform, and wrote this book and testified in front of Congress. I've spoken on panels, have done documentaries. I just think it's so important that people understand the subtleties of all of this, because it's just, until you're in it, it's very hard to understand.
And I think that's an important part of your story too, that you didn't, it's not just that you survived this and kept your child safe, and which is enough,
right?
But that now you've devoted, you know, the time since to trying to prevent this from happening to other people.
Yeah. And I do think the power in making that change is for people who are victims and survivors of these things to, if they have it in them, to share it and to, you know, make themselves raw like this and vulnerable and go back there. You know, to go back there is really hard. But I think it's really important, because I think that that's the power to make changes.
I was going to say, if we want these kind of institutional problems to change, those things only happen because of public pressure, and public pressure only happens because people understand the problem.
You know, any of us that have been through the family court circus and anything related to that, I'm speaking their language. I mean, they know, but not everybody has the chance to kind of blow the lid off that. And I think that that's why this is important. I think that that's an important part, like a pivotal part of the story, is that people understand what goes on in these courts. and the abuse and re-traumatization that happens to the good people that are just trying to keep their children safe.
Right. And again, I think I said this before, that it feels more like it needs to be a dedicated woman against the system movie more than primarily being about the danger you were in. And
yes,
you know, because there's a bigger story there.
There is. It's so much more than, you know, I am dedicated to the beginning of the story too, because, you know, I didn't know about the various forms of domestic violence, and I'm dedicated to getting that message out there. But I think the larger issue is that there's just ongoing problems and, you know, people being traumatized and re-victimized by these systems.
Well, I think they're both equally important. I think there's also a very direct connection between a sociopath who can charm you into a relationship and can also charm the authority figures. You know, that's what being a sociopath is, being able to turn it on and off and, you know, being able to say all the right things and do all the right things.
And that's been,
and make all the right promises.
Right. And that's been one of my biggest frustrations through this whole thing, is that how can these people not tell the difference between somebody that's a psychopath and somebody that's clearly a victim? Yeah, how do they not see it? I don't understand it. And I think that it's so important to convey that, like, in a big way.
You know, I was just saying there's a parallel, but it's one thing just being somebody dating. Like, I don't care who you are. You've only been in a handful of relationships in your life.
Right.
And you're not necessarily trained to see every sign and all these sort of things.
Of course not.
You know who is? Cops, or who are supposed to be.
Right?
You know?
Well, right. And that goes down a whole nother rabbit hole.
Yeah. I mean, we could do another 2 hours on.
We really could. It's like, yeah, it's something like 25% of law enforcement families experience domestic violence. So a lot of the guys that are rolling up on these domestic violence calls are the ones that are also abusers themselves. So that goes to a whole nother thing.
And it's that same thing we're talking about at the beginning with sort of the power fantasy and the guns and the, you know, stalking through the house, like
toxic masculinity.
Yeah, it's such a such a common top mentality too.
And that, oh, she must be crazy, or she must have made him snap, or what did she do? She must have been cheating. She probably deserved it. That kind of thinking.
Right. Well, also if the cop is also not even an abuser, but in that toxic mindset, like he's probably telling himself that same stuff. So of course it's easy for him to believe.
That tape is going in his mind. I was just lucky that there were a couple that actually did see my ex for who he was. But imagine if I didn't. I mean, I would have been screwed.
Oh, yeah. Well, we talked about this before, but it's so striking that at so many points, you could have gotten a worse person than you did.
Yeah.
And might have died, and you could have gotten a better person than you did, and none of this would have happened. And it's just down to the individuals.
It is.
And, you know, just like the bullet just missing your heart, like it's almost a metaphor, like, you know, everything could have been just that much different. And
the other thing I think that is really important about this story is that I am a rare person that has actually survived something like this. Most of the women that this happens to, they die. And that I'm here, and that my father is here too, and that my son is here and he wasn't hit, is just an amazing, amazing piece of this story. So many of these voices are snuffed out, and they don't get to be told. Or, you know, a story like this is told by family members who've lost their loved one, I'm here to tell this as a first person account. Like, this is what happened. And it's very rare. And the fact that we saw justice is also rare.
Yeah.
Most of these guys are, you know, 10, 15, maybe 25 tops. If at all.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, what our outcome is not the norm.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to the, you know, making a movie part of this. Do you have anybody in mind to direct the story?
I would like Ava DuVernay
to
do this. I think, not for nothing, but I think I need a female and a strong female to tell this story. Given her work, I watched 13th and it changed my life. Opened my eyes to things I didn't even realize. I think she would do an amazing job with this.
Yeah. And I mean, she's one of those directors who can do, you know, she can do 13, she can do so much, she can do A Wrinkle in Time. Like, she can kind of handle anything. But in terms of taking on material this weighty and doing it justice,
I think she would be incredible.
Yeah. I have no arguments there. I did have a couple of names, but
okay. No, I want to know
with Ava. She's great.
I want to know yours.
Well, my thought, and this was, picked this up before we started talking, before I'd heard all the details, but my thought was, you want somebody who's going to take the material seriously and make it realistic. And we talked about this earlier in the conversation. You don't want it to be a sensationalized revenge thriller.
No, you want not it, at all.
But at the same time, you do need to have that ever-present fear that you had to live through.
Definitely.
But without making it too oppressive, you want people to watch this movie.
Right.
It's a tough line to walk. Mm-hmm. And so the first name I thought of was Lynn Ramsey. Who tackled abuse in We Need to Talk About Kevin, mm-hmm. You're Never Really Here. Mm-hmm. And both of those films really focus on the lasting psychological effects of violence and living with violence and somebody you care about being capable of violence. And yet she has such a deft touch for handling that kind of material without it being sensationalistic, without it being too grim, without...
Right.
And really getting into the emotions and psychology of that violence. So I thought she could handle it. I also thought of Jane Campion, who... You know, she did The Piano in the 90s, and she mostly spent the 2000s making short films and documentaries.
Yeah.
But in 2013, she came back with Top of the Lake, which was a terrific drama with Elizabeth Moss, she's great. Honestly, this is like part of her triple crown, along with Handmaid's Tale and Mad Men. Like, this is a side thing, but I think she has the best TV career of any actor who's ever been on television.
She's amazing, yes.
because the first season of Top of the Lake was a remarkable performance by her and terrific story. And it's a female police officer who has been living in Australia, comes back to a small town in New Zealand where she grew up to investigate a kidnapping. Mm-hmm. And she digs into this case of abuse, and it gets into similar things about how the system protects powerful men and about how abusers know exactly what they can get away with and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then she's also revisiting her personal trauma. They're very serious.
Yeah, that could be good too.
Reason she left this town. Yeah. My one reservation is that Campion did a season 2 a couple years later, and I couldn't watch the whole thing because it was a little too heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm. Like, it was just heavy-handed.
They just laid on the misery, and it was just a little much. So maybe I would pull back from there. But Ava DuVernay is a fantastic choice.
I'm like, I would love that.
You know, and Lynn Ramsey, somebody who's done. I mean, like, also Ava DuVernay is somebody who could get this movie made.
Yeah.
You know, Lynn Ramsey has done a couple of indies and is somebody who I think deserves more chances
to make movies. And that's fine to me. Yeah. Like, just to get it out would just be a dream.
So for casting, I always feel, I've had a couple people come on and tell their own story, and I always feel weird saying, well, this is who should play you.
Yeah.
So I'm going to back off and let you do. I do have an idea for Tom, but I want to hear your thoughts on who should play you.
I chose Margot Robbie. Think that she would knock it out of the park as me. I think that she could portray me in a very authentic and genuine way and show, because she's younger than I am. So when I met Tom, I was 34. So she's in the age range that I was when I got together with him. And I think she could really capture that naivete at the beginning, but then kind of become this badass at the end. I could really see her like taking off with that and giving like a really inspired portrayal.
That's interesting to me too, because she has both of those sides to her and uses them to kind of a cartoony effect in the superhero movies that she does.
Well, yeah, of course.
But it would be fascinating to see her, but she's obviously done a lot of very serious dramatic work too.
Yeah.
But it would be very interesting to see her use that same dynamic in a very serious story and be somebody who, can make that transformation from naive to.
And I kind of like that she's, you know, not like a giant, giant blockbuster superstar. I don't see somebody like that playing me.
No, and I think if it's a real person's story, you want somebody who you're not constantly looking up in the story and saying, oh, that's Julia Roberts. Like, you want it to be.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, you want somebody who's going to disappear into the role.
Correct. I don't want, or that the person is associated with a very particular character or something like that. Like, I feel like she's in a good place in her career where she could do something like this and she's not. It's like, oh, that's Margot Robbie playing her. You know, like, she could become me.
Oh, yeah.
In that role. I think she'd be terrific.
Yeah, and she's in that sort of sweet spot right now where she's a recognizable movie star.
Correct.
But then she's done stuff like Bombshell Almost Time in Hollywood, mm-hmm. where mm-hmm. you're not, hey, it's Margot Robbie. Like, you know, she's playing character and you're investing in the character.
Right.
So yeah, that's a great choice.
So that was my choice.
Well, my thought for your ex, and you can tell me what you think about this, is Chris Evans, because he's, you know, he's handsome and charming and has the, you know, disarming kind of all-American good looks. And I mean, he's Captain America. He can play a military guy.
Sure.
And, you know, he has that facade, but he can be intense. And I'd love to see him cast against type as the bad guy, because
that would be cool.
Because it's something you're not, even though he was cast against type as the bad guy in Knives Out, spoiler alert for Knives Out.
Right.
Even then he's kind of a, you know, not a lovable scamp, but he's kind of a scoundrel in that one. He's not necessarily, you know, like having him play a sociopath is not necessarily what the audience is expecting. And because you don't want somebody like Michael Shannon, who's just intense and seems like he's going to strangle somebody, you know, you want somebody charming who in the early going, you need to be able to understand why, of course, you would fall for this guy and be charmed by this guy and buy into it all. And even how, you know, it's easy for law enforcement to say, no, this guy's a good guy. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, but I also think, you know, he's been, you know, doing superhero movies for 10 years. And I'm sure, A, that he is probably eager to step out of that and use his acting chops. But I also think that he has acting chops that we haven't seen from the blockbuster movies that he's done and some of the stuff he's done in between. Like, I think he's a good fit for the role and the role's a good fit for him.
It would be really interesting to see Chris Evans play a psychopath. That's definitely something we haven't seen.
Yeah, yeah.
And the subtleties that it would take to play Tom.
Yeah.
Would definitely be a challenge.
Well, it's funny. It's one thing that I'm always, I don't know, maybe suckered in by, when an actor can play somebody with different personas.
Yes.
You know, whether it's something like this or kind of a spy movie where they're turning on and off their, you know, alias or whatever, or whatever the reason for it, even though that's what actors do, you know, like an actor's whole job is to put on different personas. But if you can flip it back and forth within one story, that's always like, oh my God, how do they do that?
Yeah, I agree.
Did you have anybody in mind?
Oh yeah. You want to hear mine?
Yeah.
James McAvoy.
Oh yeah.
He's my guy. I used to think about, weirdly, oddly, I mean, years and years ago, when I thought about like, if I casted this, who would play me? Who would play Tom? And I used to say Charlize Theron as me and Jude Law as Tom.
Oh yeah.
But then I saw the movie Split with James McAvoy. And
that was my first thought. Yeah.
This guy, not only he's very handsome, but there's like, he could totally play, there's something a little off. I think he could definitely do the charm and the good looks. And I do think he could pull the military thing off. And then even from the very start, I think he would nail doing like the subtle things that my ex did.
Yeah.
Where you're kind of like a little like, huh? But then it's like, oh, but no.
I mean, yeah. Like, did I even just hear that?
To then get all the way to the shooting and then even trial and how he was at trial and what he looked like horrible. He looked like greasy and pale and just awful. I'm telling you, after I saw Split, I was like, McAvoy needs to play Maffei.
Yeah. But Split is really the thing that, like,
absolutely,
I think pushes it over the edge, because you know he can be dead-eyed and terrifying when he wants to.
Yes. And that's what you would need. But then back to, you know, your, like, Chris Evans, it would be amazing to see him do that. You know, not Captain America, you know, it'd be cool to see him.
Well, let's call him back in. Let's
become the sociopath, you know, that kind of brooding, there's like a boiling underneath thing that's going on. That's what the actor would have to capture, because that's what was going on. So, I think it's so exciting to think about like that kind of this, you know, like who could bring it to life, you know?
I hate to use the word fun after this harrowing story of
something. I know.
But that is the fun. That is the fun of the show. Getting to imagine.
It is.
You know,
it
whether
is.
Whether
I mean, it's. I'd be lying if I said I didn't think about it, because I have, obviously. I've thought about, when I did the book too, I was like, oh, it'd be interesting. It'd be fun to cast it, you know?
even if you have a very sort of ordinary life, you think about who's going to play you in the movies.
Sure.
And when you write a book, you think about who's going to play all the characters.
Exactly. You know, I lived it in real life. Sure. You know, it wasn't fun, but, you know, for these purposes, if it was made into something, you know, for massive consumption.
Well, but it already has, but because you wrote it as a book and you still have to think as a writer in story terms and characters and framing. So, I mean, so much of the story is you and your ex and, you know, I don't know enough 1 to 4 year old child actors to bandy around any names for your kids. But is there anybody else in the story you had had a casting idea for? Or, I mean, those are really the two leads. You don't really.
Yeah, I honestly, for these purposes, I just had thought of like the leads. I'd have to obviously cast my parents and, you know, my brother.
I didn't have strong ideas there because other than being, you know, supportive parents were there through the whole thing.
Right. I mostly thought through, the two leads because that's going to be the focus of the film if it was ever made, which it should be made.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's always the dream in the show that somebody's going to hear it. And,
that's right.
You know, say, okay, I have a treatment on my desk.
That's right.
So that's our movie. If you have any thoughts on Kate's story or any other movies that need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. And you can find Kate on Twitter at RavenRanta, RavinRanta. Her book, again, is called Killing Kate, A Story of Turning Abuse and Tragedy into Transformation and Triumph. It's available everywhere books are sold. You can order it from your local independent bookstore. And you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. Stay safe out there. Get your shot. Keep yourself sane. We'll be back next time on
Why is this not?